Welcome back to Middle East Forum Century Radio here on WWDB 860 AM Philadelphia Talk. I'm Greg Roman, your host, joined by my co-host Gary Gamble in studio while I'm reporting live from Israel. Our next guest, Tarek Fattah, is the Robert J. and Abby B. Levine Fellow at the Middle East Forum. He's also a one-time founder of the Muslim Canadian Congress, a columnist at the Toronto Sun, and a host of both a variant of AM talk radio stations programs in Toronto, and also his own television show, which has been broadcast to Tarek. Tell me if I'm being a little bit embellishing here, but to billions of Indian viewers, and also the author of two award-winning books, Chasing a Mirage, The Tragic Illusion of an Islamic State, and The Jew Is Not My Enemy, Unveiling the Myths That Fuel Muslim Anti-Semitism. You can follow Tarek on Twitter at T-A-R-E-K, Tarek Fattah, F-A-T-A-H. Tarek, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much. It's a wonderful day here in Toronto. Bright sun.
I have to tell you, Tarek, it's always a good time having you on the program, speaking with you in person, and I think you have a lot to say to enlighten our audience here in Philadelphia and also our podcast listeners across the rest of the world, and it's really just a delight to have you on Middle East Forum Century Radio. I think Gary
You're very kind.
Tarek, it's nice to have you today.
Good to hear your voice as well.
So, to listeners who aren't familiar with Tarek Fattah, he's our resident Canadian expert, all issues concerning Islam and Islamism in Canada. And last month, an issue that you wrote about and have campaigned about was the passage of Bill 21 in Quebec, which bans the display of religious symbols by government employees in certain sensitive positions, such as teachers, judges,
yes,
policemen.
Can
you tell us what this apparently was a long time coming, about 10 years since the...
Yes. Well, Quebec has a very unique history in that for almost a century it was under the grip, all of the society was under the grip of the Catholic Church. You couldn't get elected, you couldn't move, you couldn't get appointed anywhere. It was almost the opposite of the Protestant Orange Order, which dominated Ontario here in Toronto, and the two facets of early Canadian society. But Quebec revolted literally in a social revolution in the 60s and has since then taken a position that religion will not have anything to do with the state. Almost like the First Amendment Establishment Clause in the United States, but has actively pursued it. So Catholicism or the Catholic Church has virtually no role determining, affecting any policy decisions in Quebec. It has been some of the most progressive, if I can use the word, in terms of social services, in terms of female rights, gender equality, and so on and so forth. But the major issue that nobody wishes to talk about, the elephant in the room, is the rise of Islamism in North America. And after 9/11, perhaps the people of Quebec and the politicians there came to realize that they were being undermined. The society was being affected by quite blatant calls of the imposition of Sharia. So in about 2005, the Quebec National Assembly unanimously decided and voted to the eradication or prohibition of any Sharia law in the Quebec state. And that was led, by the way, by a Muslim woman of North African origin, who was later became the deputy speaker of the assembly. And so there was a commission established as to how Quebec would go further in secularization of its society. And for 10 years, repeatedly, governments got elected on different promises of how they would implement the Taylor Commission report. And by the time the legislation would come forward, the coalition would collapse, a new election would come up. But this time, a center-right party, the CAQ, ran on the promise that they will, as priority, establish laws that will make it transparent for any citizen to approach a public official without having to know his or her religion. It should have complete transparency. And therefore, the law, Bill 21, was passed, which does not ask people to sort of take off their hijabs or their turbans, but says any new employment, any new recruits would be barred from this. And I think the hijab was the intention, but the casualties on the sidelines were the Jewish kippah that is worn by folks in around the Montreal area, or a few Sikh turbans. So I would, for lack of a better term, there were collateral damages in trying to sound universal. They could have simply said that the flag of the Muslim Brotherhood cannot be borne on people's heads. But I don't think we are at that level in society where truth can be spoken. So the law has been passed, and the outrage expressed by Muslim Brotherhood legacy groups on one side has been countered by a very large number of Francophone Muslim groups who have come out in defense of the law, and their position has been that this is not a religious symbol at all. This is a political symbol. It comes from the Muslim Brotherhood. Perhaps no one that I know can produce a photograph of the grandmother wearing a hijab. This is, by the way, just my personal challenge to anyone amongst my Muslim friends. Can you produce a photograph that shows that this has some history and culture? No, nobody wore the hijab. I come from the Indian subcontinent. People of all religion cover their heads with the working in the fields, which is quite illogical. It's called a dupatta, but I grew up, I spent 30 years of my life in Pakistan. I never heard the word hijab and nor saw anyone wear this contraption anywhere in the university that I attended. No one in my family, my friends, even in the most orthodox side of my family, I never saw anyone. So this is a Muslim Brotherhood symbol. It's sort of a marker that many Muslim women are pushed to wear so they can stake out the territory and say, we are here to stay, literally like showing a middle finger. So the law has been passed. Hopefully it will spread to other places as well. It's also a reflection of what happened in France, which Quebec takes a direct heritage to, where the hijab and the burqa has been outlawed many, many years ago against under President Sarkozy, and people were saying, oh, if you ban the hijab, the girls will drop out of school. Not a single French Muslim girl dropped out of school. Just people had the courage to bring the law, and the Muslim Brotherhood fell in line.
And Tariq, what you're talking about here is reflective of a much larger debate about the place of religion in the private versus public sphere. You quote Muslim activist Fareed Shihi on this debate, where she says, whether we like it or not, what is most disturbing in Quebec is what I call malignant entryism by Islamists who want to impose their ideology on the host society at all costs while refusing to respect its laws. If I was to look at this in the Western context, like you just suggested, in France, there's standards that we hold our citizens to. We give freedoms that are universal. But when a minoritarian community tries to subject their standards to the rest of the majority, and even on other minority groups, by putting their entry into society first before everyone else, the government has to respond. So,
but the governments are rather weak. There is an element of what I call white guilt. And unfortunately, the left, which has played a major role in the last 60 years, 70 years, in standing up to these orthodoxies and medieval mullahism, have today, post-1990 and the fall of Berlin, they've all merged with the mullahs and what I call the Sharia Bolsheviks. And somehow both sides have developed a very bizarre anti-Americanism. And so they, it's an easy thing to be anti-American. After all, America is so big, you can find some part of it, of its culture, that's offensive, as much as there are many aspects that are absolutely exciting. So America is a target. So you will notice that none of these jihadis or Islamists will ever protest outside the Chinese embassy, where China holds about at least 10 million Muslims in re-education camps, where they are forced to eat pork, they are forced to dance, they are forced to drink alcohol, they are forced to hear Western music, and they are being bombarded and brainwashed. But not a single Islamist group in the United States or Canada would ever dare send five people outside the Chinese embassy to say, stop doing what you're doing, because China is the ally. China is the adversary of the United States, so we are pro-Chinese. It's
right, and they also take their lead from Islamist actors overseas, especially those who are heads of state. I must reference,
I think they are not overseas. I think they're in the United States.
No, not even just there, but just a news story that came up today was Erdogan's visit to Beijing, where he has branded himself as the protector of universal Muslim values. I'd say it's more Islamist values, but not a peep from him about the Uyghur situation in Western China.
No, he won't. And by the way, the Uyghurs are of Turkic background. The East Turkmenistan, it's what was once called East Turkmenistan. No, there's an element of hypocrisy, and it's shared everywhere. Look at what the United States has done. Keeping Turkey in NATO is simply outrageous. And today, United States has categorized a Balochistan group, which is pro-American, anti-Islamist, as a terrorist group. Similarly, the PKK, which is fighting Erdogan and the Turkish ultra-nationalist jihadis, the United States has put PKK also on a terrorist list. So there is an element of how effectively you can lobby congressmen and senators, and the Pakistanis are very good at doing that. So are the Turks and the Saudis. The Sunni triangle has so carefully managed the entire public relations effort that every American thinks that Iran is the main enemy. Even Israel thinks so, whereas most of Pakistan's nukes are pointed at Tel Aviv, not India. And they are barely 1 kilometer away from the Pakistan-Iranian border. But the Iranians are stupid. They don't know how to conduct themselves. There's a lot of brouhaha and bravado. While the Turks have an American base. Doha has an American base. The most anti-American people in the Middle East pose as the best friends of Americans. Saudis, for crying out loud, I lived there 10 years. It's a cesspool of jihad. I mean, nothing good comes out of this place except the dream that one day the world will be dominated by Arab Islamists, not even people like me. The theology is that people who are not Arab but are Muslims commit an act of sin if we consider ourselves equal to Arabs.
Tariq, I have to bring up, I have to bring Gary into this again, because there's a point here that you touched on another article that you wrote recently that I think he wants to make.
Well, you wrote also recently an article on vote banks in Canada.
Oh, God.
And yes, I was interested in that, because here in the United States, we have politicians who kowtow to Islamists multiculturalism and all that, but it's not because they're shilling for Muslim votes. In Canada, that's different, right?
It is, because what should have been called multiracialism accidentally got called multiculturalism. And the background to multiculturalism is the immigrants that came from Russia, Ukraine, Poland, and Eastern Europe, from Hungary after the 1956 Kremlin crackdown. Some came in 1968 from Czechoslovakia. Now, these folks felt that they had no place in the Anglo-French society of Canada. And so the pressure came to be multicultural, meaning cultures of Europe. Now, if you put in a culture which believes that handicapped people are cursed by the divine, that culture can't be included in a culture that says that people with disabilities are top of the line at every parking lot. I'm just giving an example. So the notion that all cultures are equal is absolutely nonsense. The culture that says I should have marks on my face, carved out flesh to identify with the tribe, is not the same equal to the culture that says that you would get admission into, say, Harvard based on your GMAT scores. You know, so we what happened as a mistaken name suddenly has become the breeding ground for ghettos in Canada. There are places here, there's a city here that has only members of parliament who belong to the Sikh faith. There are two ridings in which you cannot get elected unless the mullah of that area bestows his blessings on you. And the card is played so well that that particular riding, the member of parliament is gay. The mullah thinks he should be killed. But the both are partners because there is a tacit agreement of hypocrisy on both sides that says, you do our work and we will make sure that during election time, we will send in about 20,000 people to vote for you. It is the dumbing down of politics that has put Canada's democracy in danger.
It's the sectarian hook that you get when you end up having more of a melting, or rather a salad bowl than a melting pot. Everyone gets partitioned into their own political box. It gets geographically distributed. This is what we're seeing within. It's not no go zone. It seems like it's a political only go to zone for certain minority groups.
Well, there was a tradition once in Canada where the Protestants would dominate Toronto, for example. The Catholics were beaten up. There were regular days on which Irish and Polish Catholics would be beaten up. Jews would be gathered in one area. There was like ceremonial beatings. On designated days, I'm talking the early 1900s. But we have progressed beyond that after the Second World War, after we learned lessons of what happens as a result of ghettoization. The experience of the Holocaust had a deep impact on our politicians here. Even our religious politicians were quite left of center in terms of talking in terms of equality, in terms of fighting against anti-Semitism, in terms of being standing up for the rights of black citizens who have suffered in the U.S. and Canada as well. But today what we have is not statesmen trying to build visions. Today we have, particularly in Mr. Trudeau, a fairly unread, hollow sort of a handsome person goes around, photo bombing, what he calls it. There's nothing sustainable about this person. I can never get a feeling that he's read any serious book in his life. The fact is, he's never had a job before he became prime minister.
Well, maybe he got a few knocks to the head in his former career as a boxer. But Tariq, thank you for joining us this morning, and I hope that you'll come back on our program with more insights from your weekly column.
Take care.
Much appreciated.
All right. Bye-bye. After these messages, we'll be joined by Nadia Bilbasi Charters, Al Arabiya's bureau chief.